I'm going to ask our marshal to call the next case for court consideration.
This is case number A211119 in the matter of the appeal by Amy Waters of the maltreatment determination and disqualification and by John and Amy Waters of the order for a revocation of their child foster care license DHS case number 36496.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for appearing today on the Court of Appeals Zoom platform. This is one of the reasons Zoom platform does work. There's a lot of individuals that are interested in this case that we can see from our screen are listening. As I understand it today, the attorneys for respondent are going to be splitting their time equally. Is that correct?
Yes.
Perfect.
And the county would take the first half of that time?
Yes.
All right, so noted. The rules of appellate procedure do remain intact. You each will have 15 minutes for presentation of your case with the split for respondent counsel. Appellate counsel, you'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to ask you to mute yourself when you're not speaking so we avoid background noise. Additionally, when you begin your case, please indicate who you are and which party you're speaking on behalf of for our audio recording purposes. And when you're ready to proceed, Ms. Wick, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Katie Barrett Wick, and I'm counsel for relators Amy and John Waters. May it please the court. This appeal presents important issues of appellate review of agency decision-making in an underdeveloped area of law, foster care licensing. There is a need for the respondents to have a child-centered and trauma-informed approach to allegations of maltreatment made by foster children, one that's focused on the safety and welfare and best interests of the children. In this case, respondents' actions and inactions fell far short of this approach. They failed to do a reasonably diligent investigation. Rather, an inexperienced investigator prejudged the Waters, deciding the very day she learned about this allegation that Ms. Waters had committed wrongdoing and that their home was unsafe, before she had even met the Waters, let alone heard about the boys, their long history in the child welfare system, or the Waters' diligent care for them. Respondents did not consult with the boys' guardian ad litem, did not gather information from her, or the many other child welfare professionals who knew these boys, who knew the Waters, or the mental health providers who had assessed the boys and were providing therapy on an ongoing weekly basis to the family. The Waters are seeking reversal of all of the agency's decisions against them. First and foremost, the court should reverse the maltreatment by physical abuse determination that was made in only 6 days and without consulting all of the sources of sort of subject matter experts of these boys that I just described. This maltreatment determination against Amy Waters is not supported by substantial evidence when the record is reviewed as a whole. It is also arbitrary and capricious because it reflects the exercise of the agency's will rather than its judgment. With this reversed, the additional adverse determinations against the Waters fall away, but there are other reasons for why, for instance, the refusal to set aside the disqualification could also be reversed. The remedy the Waters seek is also critical, Your Honors. The harm of what happened cannot be undone in terms of the boys. The boys have been taken away and separated. That is irreparable harm. But what the court can do and what we would seek in specific relief is that the license of the Waters, their foster care license, which was valid until these hurried and prejudged investigation happened, that their foster care license be immediately reinstated so that they may go back to being this capable home to care for the many hundreds of children that are waiting for permanency in Minnesota.
This is a good question. I want to follow up on the licensing because it wasn't really clear from your brief if you were challenging or which you were challenging the commissioner's determinations about the licensing rule violations.
Sure.
So could you clarify that for me, please?
Sure. So the disqualification was based upon the maltreatment determination against Amy Waters, but as this case was litigated, there were more and more sort of rule violations that the DHS seized upon to sort of, I guess if you will say belt and suspenders, this why it would not be appropriate for the Waters to consider. And so, we see ones and we've we have challenged all of them, and I think I've caught them all in the two briefs, but the idea that they didn't provide appropriate care because they couldn't manage sort of the emotional needs of the boys. There was the allegation that there had been wrongdoing in speaking with the boys after the MCRC interview.
Ms. Wick, did your clients feel they had a sufficient due process as far as these rule violations? It appears to me when I read through Lippman's order, it seems like that was, as you're characterizing it, kind of side issues.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering what it is that you think the appellate court should do if we agree with you on your other theories.
I don't think you need to reach them because the basis for the revocation of the license was the maltreatment determination and the decision that constituted serious maltreatment under the statute. So if the court reverses that, I don't think there is a need to reach those other bases.
When I read the commissioner's ruling, it looks to be that one of the bases of the license revocation was Amy's investigation of the sexual abuse allegations after she was disqualified. Mm-hmm. And it was the commissioner determined that that was an agency rule violation. And so is there any dispute about that particular factual finding? And then what do we do with that as a basis for the license revocation?
Great question. I do want to answer your prior question very briefly, Judge Warkey. Absolutely, that that they do not believe that due process, they have not had due process sort of along the way. So I just want to pin that because that's something that's very important to them.
Well, right. But then you're going to be answering Judge Frisch, and it follows with the question I have. So what happens? I mean, if we agree with you as far as the maltreatment, what happens to it? Do we just ignore it? And could they then bring that as a new instance to affect the license?
Great question. And I promise you, I was not dodging Judge Frisch's question. So I think you particularly as to that allegation that there was some wrongdoing with Ms. Waters talking to the children, so I want to point a couple things out to you. So we address this specifically in our reply brief relating to the selective nature with which the DHS has exercised its delegation. So sort of the agency has clearly delegated this authority to Ramsey County as to the maltreatment investigation. And so the facts of that discussion that was at a park post the MCRC interview of the younger two boys, Ms. Waters had been given express authority because she was riding in the car with Mr. Waters that she was allowed to attend the MCRC. And it was after that when they literally, and I want to give you some transcript sites. So it's one transcript 158 to 159, and then 345 to 347 is where the Waters explain what happened that day. They, as soon as they left the MCRC interview, the two little boys started, they were upset. They said, we lied. Our older brother didn't do anything. We that didn't happen. And they didn't start the conversation. They did not initiate the conversation, but they are the caregivers of these boys. And their foster sons start talking to them. There was some decision because they had to pick the oldest up at school that they would take them to a park. That was, again, not driven by the Waters. I think they wanted to get outside and they were trying to, you know, be in a place where John was very aware that Ms. Waters had to be supervised. So they were able to see each other all the time. So I think, Your Honors, that there is absolutely a basis in the record to say that the facts, there is no substantial evidence to support that additional sort of post hoc justification of a revocation or of a disqualification. So that's how I would address that.
So what do we do with that procedurally? Does it get remanded for additional, or is it just reversal?
No. Reversal, because all of that information was available to the agency when it made this decision. And it had it. It didn't look at it. It didn't want to consider it because it wasn't consistent with their theory. But there's no need for a remand in any way on any of these facts, Your Honor. We feel that this is a thoroughly developed record and that the information is there. It just, when you look at the totality of it, it doesn't support where the agency wants to go. And that's, unfortunately, that falls outside the agency discretion. Yes, they have discretion to make certain decisions, but they don't have discretion to, they must conduct a reasonably diligent investigation. And I did want to draw the court's attention because you know, these things are, they are works in progress. And the more I work up a case, the more precise I see some of these issues. But I wanted to just draw the court's attention to 260E. So Minnesota chapter 260E.20, it's about agency duties regarding investigations of maltreatment. And, you know, I didn't cite the specific provision of what the agency must do, but if you look at it, it says under subdivision 3, the local welfare agency responsible for conducting a family assessment or investigation shall collect available and relevant information. And then B, it says shall collect available and relevant information. That is the legal basis for the court saying, Your Honor, that this maltreatment investigation fell short of the statutory requirements. You can't fail to talk to the guardian. The guardian was the expert who knew these boys. The guardian had seen these boys in 8 and 9 respectively prior foster homes. The guardian continued to support the Waters' attempt to adopt these boys for months after this 6-day-long maltreatment investigation. And she was deeply, she said when she found out about the decision, she was shocked and saddened. I think that's at 42 of our 42 of our addendum, or that might be the letter regarding her trying to get the, so 42 is part of the letter that was made 6 weeks, submitted to the permanency proceeding, 6 weeks after this maltreatment decision by Investigator Seiler, saying, I am concerned, I'm the guardian, I am the expert on these boys. I mean, she doesn't say that, but she is the subject matter expert on these boys. She is the one charged with determining what's in their best interest. And she says, I am afraid this adoption is not going to go through. And these boys need to be adopted by the Waters.
Ms. Barrett, Will.
Yeah.
So I found it interesting that the ALJ obviously made credibility determinations that were at the very least very implicit in his decision. And I view, since he's the one who heard 3 days of testimony, live witnesses, it was surprising to me that the commissioner then found opposite credibility determinations. Yes. And we've been looking through the case law, and I'm going to ask attorneys for respondents the same question. We defer, as an appellate court, to the credibility determinations of a district court.
Yes.
And is there any case law that the commissioner should defer to the credibility determinations of an ALJ?
I have similarly, not that I'm aware of, to be brief, I have not been able, there's not a lot of law even on what happens when there's an ALJ decision and the commissioner decides in the contrary. There's the In Re, the excess surplus Blue Cross case. None of those that I can understand from what I can see had any credibility determinations. That issue that is so classic in sort of your appellate review, deferring to the neutral fact finder that heard and could evaluate the witnesses, I have not been able to find that. And I wish that I had something more helpful to the court. But I think in this instance, you know, that I would encourage the court to articulate that and to explain that that you're not, I mean, as far as I can see, there's no reason to suggest that's not proper for you to defer to that. I'm aware of no authority to suggest that you couldn't do what you typically do to say we defer to the credibility determinations of the ALJ in this instance. And they were, you were right, Your Honor. I mean, if you look at the facts that were adopted by the commissioner, I mean, it's all but sort of the last 6, 7, 8, where then they sort of added some about their credibility determinations, really, frankly, just about, mostly about Amy Waters, but a little bit about John. And all the other facts about the rush to judgment and the sort of wrongdoing about Investigator Seiler and all that was adopted. And so I think even seeing sort of consistency within the ultimate package of findings from the commissioner is difficult, and it undermines the ultimate conclusion here.
The other thing that was surprising to me in reading the statutes is that 260E, all of this licensing didn't talk about the best interests of the child.
Yeah.
Unless you say safety is paramount.
Yeah.
Is another buzzword for best interest. And I was really surprised by that.
Yes. I agree, Your Honor. And I'm also not aware in law on that issue, but I think it's clear if we look at the subsection I quoted about the obligations to that they shall collect available and relevant information. I certainly think it's appropriate for the court to note that and to explain that you know, the kinds of subject matter experts on families and the system that the court does consider where there are the obligations to consider best interests, the guardian, the caseworker. Here we also had the foster care licensing. So we had...
I have a question about the whole licensing progress. And I'm asking you because you're in the field and obviously doing this work. And I'm mindful of course, the panel has certainly read the submission of the Real Hope Project as far as its position on the adoption process. Yes. So when the Waters have a determination made of maltreatment first, and then serious maltreatment, besides their foster care license, would this not also affect other avenues for the Waters as far as what they would do in their professional lives?
I
don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why this is so important to them to clear their name. I don't have this great list of collateral consequences for you, Your Honor, but absolutely. I mean, Ms. Waters was found to commit serious maltreatment by physical abuse on this record. And it's wrong, and it's arbitrary and capricious, and it not only impacts their ability to build the family that they so desperately want to build, but you're right. I mean,
my next question for you, and again, it's not, I'm not going to be very articulate in stating this, but if we agree with you, if we do, and the commissioner is reversed, so that essentially puts Amy and her husband back in the position where they have a foster care license. So they can then have other children, or is the possibility still open for these children?
So not as to the youngest two. They've been separated. They were returned to Clay County. The younger two have been adopted, which is the permanency aspect of that is wonderful. The part that's hard is they were pulled from these caregivers who had done so much to help them and with whom they bonded. You know, I'm not their lawyer. I'm not the children's lawyer, but the system inflicted child.
But in terms of systemic issues, if this determination was made once and their foster care license is reinstated, is there concern that they're under greater scrutiny because of that? Or is that just one of those things that may or may not happen?
Practically.
I told you I wasn't going to be very articulate in my question.
You are, Your Honor. So yes, there's concern. I mean, they will be back as a licensee of DHS. You know, I hope we can move forward in a positive way. Just to finish that answer to your prior question, the oldest boy has not been adopted. He remains in foster care. They remain very interested in, their focus is on what's in his best interest. If it's in his best interest they think some contact would be because he was the one who had experienced the most trauma of the prior adoption not happening. And so they would like to, you know, they don't know what they were told. They don't want him to think it's his fault. So I think, but the focus, Judge Werke, is that they wish to go, you know, to kind of start over. As painful as that is, there's hope in that. And there are, you know, 600, 700 kids in Minnesota who are looking for homes. So,
Your time has expired, but you'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. As we discussed, we're going to have the split. We've got to wait for the time clock to go to the split as far as respondent county first speaking. And then after that, we will hear from Mr. Dietrich. Always good to see you. But we'll watch the split and it looks like it's ready to go. Ramsey County, when you're ready to proceed, please introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf
of. Thank you, Honor. Soyan Wu Bachman, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney. And I'm appearing on behalf of Ramsey County that made the maltreatment determination. So the county is asking this court to affirm the commissioner's decision regarding the determination, and here are the reasons why. The dispute around the maltreatment determination is largely factual, and where fact-finding is concerned, the agency decisions enjoy a presumption of correctness. At this stage, it is outside of the reviewing court's role to reweigh evidence or make its own credibility findings. After all the evidence, if more than one...
So, Ms. Wu Bachman, I'll ask you the same question since you brought up credibility that I asked Ms. Barrett-Welk. I just find it surprising that on review and on the paper transcripts, the commissioner is able to make opposite credibility determinations to a fact finder who sat through 3 days of testimony. Are you aware of any case law about credibility determinations and what deference should be given to the person who sat through the trial?
I am not. But under statute, it's clear that the administrative law judge only recommends, and his recommendation is not binding on the commissioner, and the commissioner is separately tasked with.
Let's get at that a different way, Ms. Wu-Bachman. So the ALJ made certain findings, and among those findings were that the children were unreliable reporters and that the investigator committed a rush to judgment, and there were a lot of defects with the investigation that was conducted. And then those particular factual findings were actually adopted by the commissioner. And so when the commissioner in her decision references the quote, credible evidence, I don't know what that means. Does that mean the evidence that she's crediting from the ALJ that she's now adopted? Because that evidence doesn't seem to me to support a maltreatment determination. In fact, it seems to support a different determination.
Right. I can't speak to why the commissioner had adopted a lot of the findings by the ALJ, but I would like to focus the attention on her memorandum.
Why? I mean, the memorandum flows from the factual findings. So if the factual findings that she's adopting are that the children are unreliable reporters, that there's not any corroboration to the doctor's finding, and that there's a shoddy investigation that resulted in a rush to judgment, why isn't that the credible evidence? And then why isn't it erroneous for her to conclude maltreatment based on that credible evidence that she's credited?
Because in her memorandum, she had referred to some evidence that the ALJ had set aside wrongfully in the county's from the county's perspective. Her memorandum shows that she actually considered the entirety of the record more so than the ALJ did in his recommendation. She noted the commonalities in the children's disclosures while ALJ completely set them aside without much explanation. And also the ALJ seems to have just accepted the Waters' testimony without much explanation. But the commissioner, on the other hand, closely examined the Waters' previous statements, particularly to Seiler and Deputy Solhide, and from this wider array of evidence determined their credibility.
Let me ask another question. So your investigator did not record any of these interviews, and that is the recommended procedure pursuant to the statute. And the investigator also did not interview particular witnesses who had pertinent information regarding these children. Why isn't that, and of course the ALJ made note of those things, and those findings were again adopted by the commissioner. Why aren't those facts sufficient to undermine the commissioner's ultimate determination that maltreatment occurred based on this record?
Right. So it is regrettable that the interviews were not recorded, but the evidence shows that, you know, Seiler took detailed contemporaneous notes of the interview. And if the credibility of these notes is being disputed, the county raises that Seiler, for all the relator's accusations towards her for being biased, she included details in these notes that were obviously not favorable towards maltreatment determination, like the youngest sibling AS recalling that LS was hit on a deck rather than a car, and DS, the oldest sibling, initially stating that, you know, he thought LS was injured by a fall down the stairs. And I would also just like to note the case law of Zaylor versus Minnesota Department of Human Services, 624 Northwestern Reporter Second Series 297. You know, there the county worker had also failed to record the interviews, but the Court of Appeals held there was no statutory remedy for this failure, and so that was not a reversible error. And regarding Ms. Seiler not obtaining records from the children's therapist or from other stakeholders, the county is not asserting that this was a perfect investigation. I think a review or dissection of any investigation of this nature is likely to reveal some shortcomings or areas that.
Well, these are not just some shortcomings. She didn't apparently talk to anyone who had been following this family and caring about this, the boys, for years prior to her investigation. So these are not just minor shortcomings, in my estimation. I wanted to ask you, do you believe that physical abuse includes negligent behavior? Because some of the findings talk in terms of what sounds like tort law, not intentional. So,
well, in this particular case, I would argue that there was intentional action by Ms. Waters.
But that's not what the findings are. Even the commissioner found that it could have been almost accidental, right, not intentional. So that's why I'm asking you whether you believe that the physical abuse term used in the statute includes negligent behavior.
I don't believe so. And in the commissioner's order, she didn't discount the possibility of Ms. Waters deliberately hitting LS. But even if she did not specifically intend to hit and injure LS's face, the weight of the evidence, particularly Mrs. Waters' own statements, show that after discovering LS's toileting accident, she became angry and she aggressively grabbed for the child. And during this process, according to her own words, her hands came down in a very fast motion and she made contact with the child's face, as she described, in a manner harder than a tap. So by her action of aggressively grabbing for the child in an angered and frustrated state, she showed disregard for the child's safety at the time, and it was foreseeable to a reasonable person that such lashing out could injure a young child in her immediate vicinity, especially.
Your time has expired, but please wrap up, and I'll see if the other judges have any other questions.
Sure. And just to address the component of whether this contact was preventable by exercise of due care. Foster parents are subject to various rules and regulations that they are educated on from the beginning and throughout their tenure as foster parents. Minnesota Administrative Rules 2960.3080 subpart 8 forbids foster parents from rough handling, hitting, or slapping the children. And following these rules could have prevented Alice's injury. I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you. Appears there's no other questions. We'll move on to you then, Mr. Dietrich.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is R.J. Dietrich. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the Department of Human Services in this matter. Now, I would like to focus primarily on the remaining issues other than the maltreatment determination, the disqualification of Mrs. Waters, the denial of the request for reconsideration, and then the revocation of the Waters' license. But first, just to address a couple things that have been brought up. I mean, there is explicit case law, in re excess surplus of Blue Cross and Blue Shield, I believe is the case cited in the commissioner's brief, saying that the commissioner specifically owes no deference to the findings and determinations of the administrative law judge.
Why wasn't the commissioner's decision arbitrary and capricious when she didn't give any reason for why she rejected the recommendation? There wasn't an explanation, and yet she adopted most of the findings. Why isn't that arbitrary and capricious?
Your Honor, I would disagree with the idea that she didn't give an explanation. I mean, there's a lengthy memorandum in the decision that explains that these three children, children consistently identified Mrs. Waters as the perpetrator of the abuse that resulted in the bruise, consistently said that she was mad after a toileting accident, and Mrs. Waters herself, in a statement before she had even been informed of these allegations statements by the children, identified herself as the perpetrator potentially, confirmed the children's statements about the toileting accident, and she got frustrated in the car and she reached out to grab the child in frustration, and in so doing hit the child in the face. And I think the commissioner explains that. Also, just to briefly address,
so contrary to what the ALJ found, that Ms. Waters was spontaneous and brainstorming, trying to come up with what may have happened or how that happened. I don't know how that got construed from her admitting to these deliberate acts when you have an ALJ that's made such a different determination? I look at your case, I saw it in your brief, no deference to ALJ's credibility decisions, but at what point do we say, well, that's just, they're polar opposites?
Your Honor, frankly, it doesn't matter if they're polar opposites. I mean, the commissioner is entitled to be the one to weigh the evidence and make decisions about conflicting evidence. And this court is frankly required to defer to those decisions regarding conflicting evidence and cannot weigh the evidence.
Well, let's take it a different way then. Why isn't the commissioner's decision arbitrary and capricious? Because she failed to consider an important aspect of the problem. And I'll identify one of those important aspects as the first paragraph of the ALJ's memorandum. There's confirmation bias. This entire investigation is tainted by confirmation bias. And there's not word one in the commissioner's memorandum or determination addressing that important aspect of this problem. So why isn't that arbitrary and capricious by the commissioner?
Your Honor, because the commissioner's determination is supported by substantial evidence. I mean, again, we have two children who made these consistent claims, and Mrs. Waters herself largely confirming the children's statements. You know, the substantial evidence review, this court can only determine whether the commissioner's decision is reasonable based on the record and you know, cannot reverse just because this court might have made a different decision in the first instance. And so I would just go back again to the standard of review here, which is very deferential to the commissioner in this matter.
The relators make much that the commissioner erred when she stated that Amy Waters, I'm quoting, didn't deny that she caused the child's injury. How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, I think that is a reference to the best statements again in that that I believe it was a May 21st interview with Investigator Solheed and Seller, where again, before she was even you know, confronted with the fact that the children had made these allegations, Mrs. Waters identified herself as responsible potentially for the bruise.
Do you endorse the idea that that the social worker who was investigating shouldn't have had to interview the guardian ad litem, or at least talk to or read reports, or Clay County, or any of the people who had extensive interactions with these boys over the course of their time in the foster care system? Do you think that should have been part of the investigation?
I'm not an investigator. That's not up to me. I mean, I guess the investigator was investigating, you know, this specific incident, and it doesn't appear that the social worker or these other individuals had any knowledge of this specific incident. So I would guess that that's why she didn't talk to those individuals specifically. I would also say that the guardian ad litem did testify at the hearing in this matter, and you know, pointed out that ultimately she ended up supporting the decision to remove the children.
But that was not because she thought the waters were inadequate or bad. It was because she didn't know how long this investigation was going to go on and the uncertainty that it caused for these boys.
I don't know her exact testimony, but I believe, yes, that was at least part of, you know, that decision.
Mr. Dietrich, what is your thought about whether the rule violation, the sex issue, does that survive? Does it stand on alone, or how do you see that playing out?
You mean if you were to revoke or to reverse the maltreatment determination?
If we reverse the maltreatment findings, and yet we have these rule violations, has there been adequate due process on that? How do we treat that as a court?
certainly, I think there was adequate due process on that, Your Honor. I mean, there was a three-day hearing that involved the rule violations.
If we, in fact, on those rule violations decided and possibly agreed with you that they stand alone, wouldn't there have to be a different sanction crafted? I mean, 7 years, no licensing, it sounds a little harsh for something like that.
Your Honor, yeah, if you did reverse the maltreatment determination, but I think you still need to address the rule violations and whether those are supported by the record. And if you were to determine that the maltreatment determination was not, but the rule violations were, I think the proper course of action would be to remand to the commissioner to allow the commissioner to determine the appropriate sanction based on those rule violations.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? I'm concerned. I mean, if we do, in fact, rewind this, these determinations, but remanded the commissioner on the issue of the rule violation, I am concerned about this matter going back to the commissioner. Is there an alternative person that you would recommend that we send this to if we do that? I mean, there's already been determinations of abuse and maltreatment, and if we rewind that and say no, how is the commissioner going to make a determination based on a sole rule violation on the revocation issue?
Your Honor, I mean, I don't know who else you could send it back to other than the commissioner. I mean, the commissioner is the person under the law that you would have to send it back to. You know,
if that's the case, does the commissioner... So following up on Judge Frisch, and I know we're beyond time, but is there sort of like a sanction list that's appropriate for X? And you know what I mean? Like a graduated list in terms of what sanction would be appropriate? Is there some guidance, like a sentencing guidelines, but as it relates to rule infractions?
Not exactly, Your Honor. 245A.07 addresses the sanctions that the commissioner can impose, and they do say that the commissioner may impose multiple different sanctions, including fines, conditional license, all up to and including revocation, if a party fails to comply with licensing rules and statutes. The commissioner, however, does have to consider the nature, severity, and chronicity of the violation when determining what sanction to impose.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, please go ahead.
If the commissioner has to recuse from a case, who makes a decision?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm not.
That's fair.
I'm not able to answer that question.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I see that I'm out of time, so I would just ask that you affirm the commissioner's order. Thank you.
And as all of the litigants can see, we're very interested in how this process works. Well, back to you, Ms. Barrett-Wick, for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. There's been a lot of ground covered, and I want to make sure that I can touch on any remaining or additional questions the panel has. But so feel free to jump in, as you always do. You know, I want to touch on a few facts. Absolutely, Ms. Waters disputes that she ever acknowledged that or admitted that she was the cause of the bruise on the face. And I think it was you, Judge Riley, who explained what the actual transcript of the interview with Seiler and that and Solheid, which was taped because Solheid got there first. Ms. Waters was brainstorming. She was told that there had been an allegation that the middle child had, you know, she knew of the bruise because they talked with him about the bruise. And she was literally going through the last few days of how could this have happened? And she never said, I caused that, when it was clear they were being investigated because there was some concern they had caused it. She was literally going through what might have happened and when she might have had contact with the middle child's face. And she never admitted she was angry when they determined that, you know, he had had an accident and it had essentially dried. And she wasn't angry. She was frustrated that he hadn't surfaced that earlier. And she came along to the side of the car. He jumped out of the SUV and she caught him. And that's when she thinks there could have been contact with his face if that was the cause. What we really think happened, Your Honor, was when the children were asked in an open-ended way, including the middle child himself, when he several times he said he was hit in the face with a soccer ball. That's what we really think happened. I want to go to this point of the alternative potential bases for the licensure concern. I want to draw the court's attention to, in our principal brief, pages 52 and 53, where again, we make the point about all of the delegees, the licensing delegees that the DHS had delegated the issue of the safety and appropriateness of the foster care placement to, after all of these allegations and even after the maltreatment determination, the licensing agency that is, you know, the most important delegee had done a home study of the waters, and it wasn't because the licensure had to be renewed, but they have regular obligations to do home studies. This is in our addendum at 52. This was more than 2 months after this maltreatment finding, that their licensing worker had said she heard back from her supervisors, "We are going to move forward in signing your home study update as approved for foster care and adoption." So the experts, the delegees, they knew that this was a safe placement, as your honors pointed out. The ultimate change on the stand, you know, more than a year after the fact, by the guardian was not that she had any concern about the safety. It was that the boys needed permanency, and that was a real concern. I do want to touch on, you know, this is an important case for the reason I started with. I mean, it's critically important to the waters. You've touched on some of the grave concerns they have about this, you know, sticking with them reputationally and in terms of their ability to have a family. But this is a decision where the court has an opportunity to provide some guidance, I think, that will be helpful in this underdeveloped area of law. And I wanted to go back to the kind of county obligations to maltreatment investigations and just point out that it would be appropriate, for instance, for the court to, in its decision, to provide some substance to what that investigation has to involve, such as gathering information from the guardian ad litem, gathering information from other child welfare professionals, such as the foster care licensing caseworker. And in this case, we had the two county caseworkers, reviewing and considering relevant psychological, medical, and behavioral information about the child and the family, using best practices regarding interviewing, recording the interviews of the children, remaining open-minded and fair-minded to the course of investigation to take in all information before rushing to judgment. Any one of these instances or failure to do any one of these things might render an investigation flawed. And in this case, we had all of them. The state says they're not entitled to a perfect investigation. Yeah, they're not entitled to a perfect investigation, but they're entitled to a reasonably diligent one. And the language and spirit of that statute about the obligations to investigate has to be met. And that it was just so far from what should have been done here. And as I said, that there's aspects of this that cannot be unwound. And I don't know what remedies there can be for those aspects, but the court should put the waters back with an active license. Judge Frisch, you are correct. Remand to the commissioner for all sorts of reasons. They don't have the same sort of timeframes you do to make decisions. They've strung this out. They waited for the reconsideration far longer. And I think this record allows the court to say this other alleged licensing violation, which ironically has to do with not making children talk more than one time about a particular concern because it might affect the credibility. That's exactly what they did, by the way, in these sort of many, many interviews with leading questions. But putting that aside, this court can appropriately say that licensing violation cannot be sustained. That is not supported by substantial evidence when the record is viewed as a whole, and just reject that and let the waters move forward. Yes, as a licensed foster care family, they will have to continue to work with these agencies. I hope we can move forward with a fresh start because the waters want to help these kids and they want to be a foster parents once again and adopt. So any other questions from the panel?
It appears not, but speaking on behalf of the panel, I do want to compliment all of the interested parties as far as the briefing in this matter was very